A preview of some films of the upcoming Ebert Fest, which starts in Champaign later this week. Today, we speak with festival co-founder Chaz Ebert about this year's themes of kindness, compassion, and empathy.
Cinema is not only about entertainment. It's also about putting yourself into the shoes of another person and experiencing some sort of first-person empathy.
Also, why is there so much arguing about climate change?
It's not because the science isn't solid. It's because climate change has become one of the most politically polarized issues in the entire United States.
Texas Tech climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe joins us to talk about the intersection of climate, politics, and religion, and our regular Monday politics segment. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo today. The 19th annual Roger Ebert Film Festival starts this Wednesday. On Friday, Nyla spoke with co-founder and host of Ebert Fest, Chaz Ebert. We'll hear that interview in just a minute, but first, a preview of some of the films that will be featured this week.
As long as the roots are not severed, all is well, and all will be well in the garden.
You know, I'm an athlete. If I want to get fit, I know what to do. But it was like my mind was always, in a sense, detached. Being able to look myself in the mirror and say it. This is an illness that I have.
Carol O'Connor walked into a room, sat at a table. We said our pleasantries. We didn't get off the first page before I knew. My God, this was Archie Bunker.
No welfare states.
Everybody pulls his weight.
She are all a smile and great.
I'm Nyla Boodoo. That is a montage of films that will be part of the upcoming 19th annual Roger Ebert Film Festival, commonly known as Ebert Fest. That's part of the slate for this year's festival. The co-founder and host of the festival, Chaz Ebert, is on the line with me now. Hi, Chaz. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you, Nyla. It's good to talk to you again. I just want to say that when I last spoke with you, we were talking about the Academy Awards, and we talked about a possible upset of Moonlight winning over La La Land.
Can we just go back to that moment? Because can we go back to the craziness of that before we even get to Ebert Fest? Because I want to relive that with you. How crazy was that? When I was sitting there at home, I almost started crying. I was so dejected, and I almost turned the TV off because I was so upset that Moonlight didn't win.
Yeah.
What was going through your head when all of that happened?
I couldn't believe it. It felt like I was in a movie. And I remember all of the people that I talked to who told me they had voted for Moonlight, and I was thinking, were they just being kind, or how
not
could this
telling
be?
You the
but,
truth.
You know what? One thing about when you have a moment like that at the Oscars, it's seared in your memory forever. You know, at first some people said, oh, I feel so sorry for Moonlight. I said, you know, people will remember Moonlight that win forever.
They really will. Were you excited that Moonlight did win?
I was excited that Moonlight won, and I was also excited that the La La Land people were so gracious about correcting the error and moving forward and making sure that Moonlight had their chance to have their day in the, you know, in the spotlight.
It was really such a remarkable display of civility and kindness in the way that Jordan, I'm trying to remember his last name, the producer.
I think it's Horowitz.
That's right, Jordan Horowitz, when he said, hold on, I've got to correct this.
Yes.
You guys won. I think people tend to think of Hollywood as sort of this competitive, you know, hyper-competitive place. For you, I was wondering about that exchange and, you know, he talked about how they're both sort of these really small films. And
mm-hmm.
They really got to know each other. Yeah.
Yes. You know, it actually, what you just said leads me into Ebert Fest, because this year we are, you know, we usually donate the we usually dedicate the festival to a person, but this year we're dedicating it to four principles: empathy, compassion, kindness, and forgiveness. And you saw some of that night at the Oscars. And it's that kind of spirit that I'm hoping that we can encourage, not just at our film festival, but in the nation. You know, the other, and we're dedicating this year's Ebert Fest to an organization, the Alliance for Inclusion and Respect. They were formerly the Champaign County Anti-Stigma Alliance. I think that it's so important to remember that cinema is not only about entertainment, it's also about putting yourself into the shoes of another person and experiencing some sort of first-person empathy, which inspires people to commit these acts of kindness and compassion. And so that's the theme this year of the 19th Ebert Fest.
Chaz, when you think about that, you have a couple panel discussions, one that you're moderating called Empathy and Compassion in the Arts. What's your goal with that panel conversation? Before we get to the films, you know, there are three things. I wonder, what are you hoping people get out of that conversation?
Let me tell you why we're having that particular panel. That panel will consist of 24 Ebert Fellows, and the Ebert Fellows are emerging writers, film critics, filmmakers, and technologists who have been mentored at some program around the country, whether it was at Sundance, at Film Independent in L.A., at Telluride, in Chicago, at the Columbia College, or in Hawaii. And these Ebert Fellows, they're scholars who are coming in from all over the country. And we couldn't bring all of them in. They couldn't all come, but at least 24 of them will be there. 10 will be sitting on a panel on stage, and 14 will be sitting in the audience. And what we're talking about is not only sort of defining empathy and compassion in the arts, but I want to hear their sort of firsthand accounts of how those mentorships have changed the way that they look at art, have changed the way that they view the world, and have changed the way that their actions toward other, you know, what they think and how they act toward others. So I think that that is an important panel.
When you think about that, that makes me think about one of the films that you've chosen for this year's festival, which is Pleasantville. If everyone remembers that from 1998, with a very much younger Tobey Maguire and Reese Witherspoon and
right.
Jeff Daniels, it's such a fascinating pick. What was behind picking Pleasantville?
Well, I'll tell you why we picked Pleasantville. Besides the fact that its director Gary Ross is such an important director and his it's just a film that has been on Roger's list. You know, Roger and I used to make these lists about who would we like to have at the festival at some point. And Pleasantville has been on Roger's list for a long time. He awarded the film 4 stars, and he just said that it's a film that sneaks up on us. And it goes back to, like, those old black and white sitcoms like Father Knows Best, but it pretends to be a sitcom, and it ends up being a social commentary of surprising power. So I think that that's going to be a great surprise for some of our audience who've never seen it.
I just think I love how delightfully subversive Reese Witherspoon's character is in on that, right? Like, I think she's just such a fun role for her. The way that she plays this modern woman in this 1950s. I'm just amused by, thinking about that. What? Let's talk about
that,
some.
I just have to tell you that this particular movie is. I usually don't bring up all of our sponsors while we're talking, but there's a reason that I'm bringing this one up. This particular movie is being sponsored by Steak and Shake, and there are some certain things they're going to do in a promotion after the showing of the movie. But I just wanted to bring that up.
Yeah, because of all the diner scenes, right? Is that why? That's really funny. I should, since we're talking about sponsors, and I should make a disclosure that Ebert Fest is held in collaboration with the College of Media at the University of Illinois, which, of course, is where Illinois Public Media is housed. So that is my full disclosure for our audience, so they know the relationship between Illinois Public Media is also housed within the College of Media at the University of Illinois, even though, of course, we have editorial independence. That's just my disclaimer for everybody who's listening.
Okay.
Chaz, what else are you very excited about? There's so many films that we could talk about here. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I want to tell you that we are showing three documentaries for the first time. And part of that is because of the principles that we dedicated the festival to. The Alliance for Inclusion and Respect. It was formerly called the Champaign County Anti-Stigma Alliance. They're sponsoring a movie called Mind Games, and it's about this female athlete. Her name is Shamique Holzclaw, and she was at one time called the female Michael Jordan, and she was challenged with being diagnosed as bipolar, and it talks about her athletic prowess as well as the challenges that she faced with her mental health issues. And that's one that where we're going to have a big panel discussion on stage in the Virginia Theater rather than at the smaller panel, because we think that this is something that the entire community of filmgoers should experience.
Yeah, so. Challenging stigma through the arts. So
yes.
That's a panel of the discussion that you also have with that.
Mm-hmm.
You also have a panel discussion about why documentaries matter. Why was it so important for you to include documentaries this year? You alluded to that's something new that you're doing this year with Ebert Fest.
Yes, and it was, because of the principles. I think that more so than, the narrative feature films, documentaries usually do shine a light on some aspect of empathy, compassion, or kindness, either that's there or needed. And two of the films, one of the films is going to be very difficult for some people. It's called They Call Us Monsters, and it's by Ben Lear. This is his debut directing. This is about juveniles who were sentenced to life imprisonment for crimes they committed before they were 17 or 18 years old. And one of the things that you'll see in the film is a bipartisan discussion about whether children that age have had the requisite brain development to completely tell right from wrong, or whether there are some opportunity for redemption.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
that's where we come in with the idea of forgiveness, empathy, compassion, but we also take a look at the victims of their crimes. So it's very balanced.
Chaz, that's a big topic to tackle. Chaz, I was just saying, Chaz, that's a huge topic for you to tackle. It's fascinating to think about. That's a very big issue to think about engaging through film.
Mm-hmm. This is Ben Lear. Happens to be the son of Norman Lear. And just coincidentally, both Ben Lear and his father will be there with their films. This was not by plan or design. It's just that they both happen to have two good documentaries out the same year. So I think that maybe the apple didn't fall far from the tree, because I, too, thought that that was a big topic for Ben to tackle. But he tackles it in a way through the arts. Because he goes into prison and teaches screenwriting classes to these young, the young offenders. And I'm not going to explain the whole movie, but it's a movie that I think our audience will, I think it will enlighten them, but I think they will also enjoy as so.
Speaking of Ben Lear, can we talk about Norman Lear, Just Another Version of You? That's also something that you are going to be playing.
Yes. And, Norman Lear, God bless him, is 94 years old. He's still sharp as a tack, and he still does so much with social justice. If you recall, he was the one who bought a copy of the Declaration of Independence and toured it all over the country so that everybody could see it and touch it and talk about what it meant and what these ideals mean for us in our nation. This movie, though, is a documentary about his life and about how he, at one time, had put more African-American characters in his TV shows in prime time than anyone else in the history of television. So talk about empathy, you know, compassion, and stepping into the shoes of another person. Norman Lear exemplifies that.
Empathy, compassion, kindness, forgiveness, those are the themes of the 19th annual Ebert Fest, Roger Ebert's Film Festival, co-founded and hosted by Chaz Ebert, who we've been speaking with. Starts on Wednesday, goes all throughout the weekend. Chaz, any final thoughts on the festival?
Yeah, I want to tell you about something that even if there are people in the community listening, even if they can't attend the whole festival, Sundays at Ebert Fest is something that we've been doing for a while. We try to end with some sort of music-related movie, and this year we're ending with De Lovely. It's a movie by Erwin Winkler. It's about
Cole Porter.
Yeah, and we're going to have some people on stage singing live. Jimmy and Donnie Demers will be singing Cole Porter songs live on stage after the performance, after the movie.
Okay, great. Well, I feel like we should play some of that music now for everyone to hear it. But thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. Chaz Ebert talking to us about the 19th annual Ebert Fest, which starts this week in Champaign. Chaz, always a pleasure.
Thank you, Nyla.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. Climate change has become one of the most politically polarized issues in the United States. In such a politically charged environment, are we still able to act on climate, or is it too late? Joining me now in studio to talk about the complex science and societal issues surrounding climate change today is Catherine Hayhoe. She's an atmospheric scientist and associate professor of political science at Texas Tech University, where she's also the director of the Climate Science Center. In 2014, she was named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People. Catherine's visiting the University of Illinois today to give a lecture on this issue later this afternoon. We'll tweet out all that info if you follow us at 21STShow, and we'll also have it available at our website. Catherine, welcome to the 21st. So glad you're here today.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the science, I want to ask you about this point you've made about how politically polarizing the issue of climate change is. Here's how you explain it in one of the episodes of your PBS digital series that came out last year called Global Weirding, Climate, Politics, and Religion.
Regardless of what we might think about climate change, many of us have bought into a very insidious myth about it. To care about climate change, we think, we have to be a certain type of person. If we're a green, granola-eating, Birkenstock-wearing liberal, we do. Otherwise, why bother?
How did we get here, Catherine? How did we get to this point where you have to be a certain type of person to care about climate change?
That is a great question, because as a scientist, I know that a thermometer isn't liberal or conservative. It doesn't give you a different number depending on how you vote. Yet somehow this issue of climate change has become one of the most politically polarizing issues in the entire United States, to where the number one predictor of our opinion as to whether or not the planet is warming, whether thermometers are correct, and whether humans are responsible, is not how much we know about the science, but simply where we fall on the political spectrum. We got to this not because we actually have a problem with science. The same science we use in our climate models, we use in designing our airplanes, we use in the way our stove cooks food, we use in our refrigerators and our phones. We don't actually have a problem with science. We have a problem with the implications that our energy consumption is warming the planet. To put it simply, as one man did after he heard me speak, he said, "You know, I wasn't really on board with what you were going to talk about, but everything you've said makes sense. My problem is I don't want the government telling me how to set my thermostat."
Interesting. So that's basically what it comes down to. So how do you talk to people in this environment. How do you talk about the science of climate change in this polarized environment?
I talk about climate change by not talking about the science often. Rather than starting with science, continuing with science, and ending with science, like I used to when I first started to talk about this issue, now I begin by talking about an issue that I share a concern or a love for with the people or the person that I'm talking to. Do we have a shared concern about the future of water in the place where we live? Do we care about a mutual interest like birding or cycling? Do we care about our kids' health? Do we care about the economy or national security? These days, it's hard to find something that we can't connect to climate. And so once we've bonded over that shared value, then connect that to climate, sharing from the heart rather than from the head. Here is why I'm concerned, because it affects this thing that you and I both agree that we care about. And then if we have time, and if there's a need, at that point we can do some explaining as to why climate change affects us and how things are changing in the place where we live. But the most important thing to do is to always, always, always talk solutions. Positive, inspirational, possible solutions, things that were already happening today, things that can happen soon in the future, things that are good for us. Because we don't really have a problem with the science, we have a problem with the perceived solutions.
So how did you come to this way of talking about it? I assume at some point you were giving talks about this and you were talking about the science of it, and it probably just wasn't getting through like you wanted it to. You weren't having the same effect on people when you talked to them like this. How did you get from point A to point B?
That is exactly what happened, and it has been a long journey, at least 10 years or more, of getting from A to B. Because as a scientist, I feel, as most scientists do, that if we just tell people the facts, they'll get it, right? The biggest lesson I have learned is that arguing facts today on a highly politically polarized topic just deepens the divide between us. It gets us nowhere. And so when I talk to people about climate change and moving to Texas 10 years ago, people were curious, and they started to ask me questions. I realized most of those questions, once you got past the how do we know it's not a natural cycle and is it really warming, most of those questions had nothing to do with the science. They had everything to do with things that are near and dear to our hearts. What does this mean for me and my family? What does it mean for my faith? What does it mean to the economy and my kids' future?
Of course, there's political issues, as we've discussed here, but you've said that religion also gets tied into this issue as well. Your husband is an evangelical pastor. The two of you co-wrote a book in 2009 called A Climate for Change, Global Warming Facts for Faith-Based Decisions. What's the message of that book?
The message is that as Christians, we should not only not be resistant to the idea that humans are changing the planet, because it says in Genesis that God gave us humans responsibility or dominion over this planet, but we should actually be out at the forefront if we take what the Bible says seriously. Because when you look at what's happening in this world, and this is what I'm going to be talking about this afternoon, you see that climate change is disproportionately affecting the poor and the vulnerable, people who already lack sufficient food to eat or clean water to drink. The very people who, as Christians, we believe that we are told to care for and to love, they are being most impacted by this issue.
Interesting. Let's just listen to a quick clip of one of your PBS episodes that talks about religion.
Climate change isn't just a scientific issue. It is also a question of right and wrong. Science can tell us what's likely to happen to our food, our water resources, our health, even our economy, depending on how much fossil fuels we burn. But this is where the science stops. Science can't tell us what's the right thing to do. We have some tough choices to make. And for that, we need to engage our hearts. And for many of us here in North America and around the world, what's in our hearts has a lot to do with our faith.
So as you talk to Christians and other people of faith, you know, about this topic, what's the response when you make this argument to them that it is a moral issue as well? What's their response, and maybe what's any resistance that you received to that argument?
Well, we've been told that we can't be the person who we are and agree that climate is changing. We're told that we can't be a Christian, or sometimes even we can't go the type of church we go to and say that climate is changing, because that's not part of who we are. It's been lumped in with, you know, it's just this liberal issue, that if you agree with that, you have to agree with everything else that goes with the political party that people might not agree with. And the reality is that agreeing with the science of what's happening to our planet, agreeing with tens of thousands of lines of evidence, some of them in our own backyard saying the planet is warming, and for the first time in the history of the planet, it really is us. There's nothing about that that's inherently political or even religious. But our response to that does come from the heart. And so saying to people, this is who you are. You are a person who cares about this incredible planet that we've been given. You're a person who cares about people who are poor and vulnerable. Holding up a mirror and saying, this is what we look like. This is who we are. And it is the most natural thing in the world for us to care about this. That is the way to make the connections and to move forward, because then we feel as if caring about this issue and acting on it is actually a genuine expression of our identity rather than requiring us to completely change who we are and become someone that we never want to be.
We've had some people on our show recently who've seen coal mines shut down, and it devastated the economies of their town and ended what was a family tradition for many generations. They want to hold on to those jobs as long as they can. For someone who's just struggling to get food on the table, who might not be seeing the immediate impact of climate change, how do you get into a conversation about climate change, long-term effects, and how it impacts them?
Mm-hmm. The coal industry is a tough one because the reality is that jobs in the coal industry have been declining for decades already. Nothing to do with policy on climate change, just the reality that it's a very expensive and inefficient way to get our energy. Natural gas is cleaner. It gives us more energy per unit burned. And now, increasingly, especially down where I live in Texas now, wind and solar energy is becoming so cheap that it's actually outcompeting natural gas, let alone coal. So my heart absolutely goes out to families and to areas that are being affected by this. And I think the solution is, again, what we see happening in places like Texas, where companies are taking out of work oil workers who've lost their job as oil prices soar, and they're retraining them to do solar energy installations. The reality is that our world is changing. And at this point, pouring money into shoring up the coal industry is like pouring money into shoring up the horse industry after Henry Ford has already built his assembly line and is turning out Model T Fords. The world is changing, but at the same time, we cannot afford to leave behind those who will be economically left behind by these changes. They deserve our assistance as well.
You mentioned you're in Texas. A large part of that economy historically has been driven by oil and natural gas. I'm curious, have you gotten pushback on your research on climate science, you know, from those industries and from people who work in those industries?
Oh, yes. I think my record is probably 200 hate mails in one day. I would say that I get negative feedback and pushback on social media, on Facebook or Twitter, via email or old-fashioned letter. I get that probably anywhere from 5 to 20 times a week. So, yes, I get a huge amount of negative feedback. And why is that negative feedback? Is it, again, because people really have a problem with the science? No, we don't really have a problem with the science. We have a problem with the implication of the science and what we think it means for our lives.
I'm curious, you know, typically you just, I know every piece of mail is a little bit different, but if you had to say what your typical piece of hate mail is on this topic, what does it look like?
Well, interestingly, it's going to be from a man, not a woman. It's going to be somebody who is white, not a person of color. I tracked the negative comments on my Facebook page over a course of a year, and out of about 1,000 comments that were negative, one was from somebody who was not white, and four were from someone who was a woman.
Wow.
So that's who it's going to be from, first of all. Uh-huh. There is a very large chance that they definitely voted for the current president. There's also a fairly large chance that they self-identify as Christian. About half of the people who send me negative stuff, you know, identify themselves as being Christian at the same time as they're typing hateful things into their computer screen. And it generally runs along the lines of some combination of you're an idiot. Everybody knows it's a natural cycle. God is in control. And fossil fuels are our future. You're just in it for the money.
Interesting. Do you ever find it hard to focus on doing your job, you know, in the midst of getting that kind of negative response that comes in on a regular basis?
Absolutely. In fact, figuring out how to deal with that negative response was one of the hardest things that I've had to deal with over the past 10 years. And what I had to do was something that is really difficult for a scientist, and that is to give up the right to be right. Because as a scientist, I know that every argument that's come along, I have an answer to that argument. I have an answer to every single but what about question. But I've learned that my answer will not change anybody's minds. In fact, when I respond with the facts, it just escalates into a downward spiral that ends even worse than the first comment. So the hardest thing for me has been to say, you know what? For a certain portion of the population, about 10% of people are dismissives. And I actually talk about that on my Facebook page today, how 10% of us are dismissives. Dismissive means that whatever evidence we're presented with, we will dismiss it. And so giving up the right to be right has been the hardest thing for me. But letting go of that is the only way that we can actually cope with this, to say, you know what, that's what you think. And I have to recognize I'm never going to change your mind.
Very interesting. So I guess how do you know from those comments whether you've got a person who simply their mind will not be changed, mm-hmm. they've decided this is their position and they're not going to change it, or that there might be someone who's open to having at least a discussion with you on the topic?
Sometimes you can't tell, and I always give people the benefit of the doubt. If there's any doubt at all whether it's sincere or not, I absolutely respond. And you can usually tell within the first response to that whether it is sincere or not.
Hearing everything that you've said, you've got the scientific arguments, the moral arguments. We didn't touch on this, but there's a prediction that the Marshall Islands will be entirely underwater by the end of the century if we don't take action against climate change. Given all of this, why is it still so hard? What's preventing us from making decisions that will at least slow climate change?
That is a great question. As individuals, often it's because we aren't given those options right in front of our faces. Until recently, it was hard to find those cool new LED light bulbs. Electric cars are expensive. I'd love to have some solar shingles like Elon Musk is making, but I don't even know where to get them. I don't think they're on the market yet. So for individuals, it's really hard to actually be able to make the choices. But the bottom line is that we are subsidizing the heck out of fossil fuels. With tax breaks and subsidies around the world, we're talking at least an order of magnitude or more greater than the subsidies going into renewable energy. So we don't have a free economy. We have an incredibly skewed economy that is skewed in the direction of maintaining the status quo against the direction of positive change.
Mm. Catherine Hayhoe is an atmospheric scientist, associate professor in the Department of Political Science, and the director of the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech University. And she is speaking later this afternoon on the University of Illinois Urbana campus. We'll tweet out all that information if you follow us at 21STShow. We'll also have it available at our website, 21stshow.org. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us on the 21st today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Stay tuned. Coming up next on the 21st, we'll bring you the latest in Illinois politics. We'll talk with Brian Mackey, who covers state government and politics for Illinois Public Radio, and Matt Dietrich, the editor of Reboot Illinois. Stay with us. That's coming up next on the 21st. You're listening to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. Each Monday, we bring you the latest in Illinois politics. Today, we're joined by two political reporters to help us understand what's behind all the headlines. Brian Mackey covers state government and politics for Illinois Public Radio, and Matt Dietrich is the editor of Reboot Illinois. Gentlemen, welcome back to the 21st.
Good to be here.
Hey, Brian, once again, you've failed to find a third Brian for our panel today. I'm a little disappointed.
I know. I need to work on that.
You can call me Brian. I'll go by Brian today. I'll be an honorary Brian.
Yeah, very good. Brian Mackey, let's start with you. The State House has been considering a bill related to funding for abortion, House Bill 40. Governor Rauner said last week that he will veto that bill. What would this bill do, and why is the governor against it?
Yeah, it really does two things. One, as you pointed out, it would allow insurance coverage of abortion for Medicaid recipients and state employees. And so there's this idea of what opponents would say taxpayer funding of abortions. And that is the reason that Governor Bruce Rauner cited in saying that he did not want to support or would veto this legislation. He was getting a lot of heat from his right flank on that. The bill also would repeal so-called trigger language, where Illinois law, and there is some dispute about whether this is actually the case, but you can interpret it that way. But some of the activists say that Illinois law says if Roe versus Wade is ever overturned in the U.S. Supreme Court, that abortion would immediately become illegal again in Illinois. And so they are saying, and that's kind of the people who are pushing this bill say that's what they're kind of focusing on. The opponents are focusing on this funding question.
Sure. Matt, over to you. In a recent interview, Republican State Representative Barbara Wheeler said that while she doesn't know where the governor stands philosophically on House Bill 40, she does know that he is personally pro-choice. As the governor gets ready to face another election, I'm curious where he stands with social conservatives in Illinois' Republican Party.
Well, he is going to have this bill really does paint him into a corner. If should the Democratic-controlled General Assembly pursue it and pass it and send it to him, they could put him in a bit of a bind because, as you know, remember, Brian, he ran in 2014 on a platform that included a statement that I have no social agenda, and I was always skeptical of that because really a governor. If you come in saying you don't have a social agenda, you're going to have a social agenda forced upon you, and you're going to have to make some choices related to that. This bill is going to have to force him to make a choice on a very controversial social issue. So this is, I think, now aside from the substance of the bill, I think politically, this is going to be one of the most interesting pieces of legislation that we're going to see discussed over the next year. And obviously, it was introduced immediately after the election of Donald Trump as, one of the first signs of some real blowback against what a lot of liberal Democrats saw as, fears about some of these measures that might be taken by the new administration.
Sure. Brian, let's talk about the 2018 governor's race for just a minute. Last week, Governor Rauner visited 10 different cities across Illinois, and that trip was funded by his campaign, but the governor insists that it's not part of his reelection effort. What's happening here?
Yeah, I've seen a range of interpretations of that, ranging from, well, it was sort of a soft rollout of his reelection push to his campaign said, it was an abundance of caution. I mean, the governor certainly spends a lot of time traveling the state, talking up his agenda. Today, as we're taping this on Monday, he's got, I think, one or two events on his public schedule where he's going to talk about necessary reforms for Illinois. It's some variation of that phrasing is what he usually says. So this comes at a time when a affiliate of the Republican Governors Association is running these TV ads where he's seen with in what appears to be a workshop or at least a very workshop looking television set and has some duct tape. And he's saying that, we can't have more duct tape fixes for Illinois. And he's spreading that message, through that paid media and as well as in these appearances around the state and from people like us repeating it. And it seems that he is not yet ready to say he's campaigning for re-election, even though he has said in the past that he is definitely going to seek re-election. There's no mystery about that.
Sure. Matt, your thoughts on the governor's non-campaign trip?
Well, I think there were two forces that were really driving it. And I should point out, it's not unusual for the governor to do this. He did it last summer as soon as the stopgap budget passed. He was out again on the trail talking about these exact same things at different stops. I don't think those stops were paid for by the by his campaign. I don't think he was flying around in a plane that was paid for by the campaign. But I think there are two things that are driving last week's string of appearances and what continues to go on. And that is, Number one, I think, is that you have the Democrats who want to challenge him in 2018 are already out of the gate. And you have, especially in J.B. Pritzker, you have someone who is going to have money to match Bruce Rauner every step of the way. In fact, Pritzker just put in, what, $7 million, I think, into his campaign last week. So I think, number one, the governor was getting out that, you know, you have these, you have Chris Kennedy and Dan Biss and Ameya Pewar and J.B. Pritzker ripping Rauner with their announcements that they're going to run against him. And he wanted to start counteracting some of that message. And I think that another reason why he needs to do these things is that it's going to be hard for him in 2018. The way things are shaping up now, he could be running for re-election next year without ever having passed a budget as governor. And that's probably the biggest responsibility any governor has, is keeping government functioning. If it goes the way it's looking like it's going now, and if higher education continues to crumble, if you have our social services web still losing funding, if we are still piling up unpaid bills to the record levels, he's going to have to run on a platform that says, here is what I wanted to do, but the Democrats wouldn't let me do. They wouldn't put in term limits. They blocked it. They wouldn't freeze property taxes. I wanted to freeze your property taxes. They wouldn't let me. And I think if you're going to run on a platform of here is what I wanted to do but wasn't able to, you better get that message out and start repeating it early. And that's clearly what he's doing. Actually, he's been doing that ever since he became governor. Mm-hmm. Back in 2015, in the summer of 2015, around one of the groups that supports Rauner was running TV commercials in the summertime of an odd-numbered year, a non-election year, against Mike Madigan, talking about, you know, blaming him for the mess that Illinois is in. So I think when you have, you know, this what's kind of been nicknamed the non-campaign campaign that's going on now, I think what it is the governor recognizes that he's got a tough message to deliver in an election year next year, and he's certainly got the means to repeat it enough that it's going to be on people's minds. And so it could be effective. I don't know, but we've never seen this before.
Sure.
Wants to run as an outsider still. That's the thing, is he, you know, even though he has been and has actually admitted and used the phrase, I'm a politician now, for 2 years in office and about 2 years campaigning before that, he still, his real, I think what he sees as his path to victory is running as an outsider, as Matt said. It's the Democrats' fault. I still want to shake up Springfield and bring back Illinois. He's basically going to be repeating his playbook from his previous campaign. He certainly has essentially an infinite amount of money to put behind that message for political purposes. I mean, there's only so much advertising time you can buy on television stations, and I guess you could blanket the web, but that's what's really going to be interesting to see. I mean, it would be a very unusual campaign approach to have to do that, but then we are in very unusual times here in Illinois.
Yeah, Brian, yeah, I wanted to ask you. I'm sorry, Matt. Wanted to ask a little bit about the Democratic side of this campaign, and you touched on it a little bit here. You've got a pretty big field of candidates, Brian, and some of them, like J.B. Pritzker and to a lesser extent Chris Kennedy, have a lot of money to fund their own campaigns. And then there are others like Ameya Pewar and Daniel Biss saying that Democrats shouldn't nominate another rich guy. How are you seeing the dynamic on the Democratic side play out right now, Brian?
Well, it's very early, but, you know, again, everything is sort of revolving around going up against Governor Rauner. But this also goes to what has become a sort of schism in the philosophical approach, if you will, for the hearts of the Democratic Party. Right. On the one hand, you have your well-funded candidates who and on the other side, you have your kind of self-styled scrappy insurgents. A lot of people want to look at this and say, well, Pritzker is the Hillary Clinton and, you know, the other Senator Biss and Alderman Pewar are kind of competing to be the Bernie Sanders in Illinois. Now, obviously, there's limits to historical analogies, and Hillary Clinton had a lot of baggage and a long history of public service that Pritzker lacks, and Pritzker is a lot more unfamiliar to voters in Illinois. But you have that dynamic, I think, or at least particularly the people who are kind of the financial underdogs are trying to portray that kind of dynamic. We are the candidates of the people. We don't need more rich people telling Illinoisans what to do. And we don't, you know, there are people who have said Pritzker would just be a sort of a liberal or a Democratic version of Governor Rauner, sort of using his money to keep people in line, versus the argument that, you know, Governor Rauner having an essentially infinite amount of money to spend on politics, it would certainly be helpful not only for the governor's race if Democrats had somebody who could fund to that extent, but then that takes pressure because, you know, the typical Democratic donors could focus their money on state legislative races and other seats that are going to be competitive.
Sure.
And Brian, we should point out, too, that as of right now, Chris Kennedy put in $250,000 into his campaign, all campaign limits were off in the governor's race. So my theory is that whoever becomes the candidate, right now we have kind of the two money candidates and the two non-money candidates, but my theory is that whoever becomes the candidate, if it's Dan Biss, Amaya Pawar, whoever it is, they will become very quickly the money candidate because I think you'll see huge Democratic money pouring into whoever the candidate is. You know, J.B. Pritzker put that $7 million in. Should Dan Biss eventually win the Democratic primary, all that money could be shifted over to Dan Biss or Amaya Pawar. There is no limit. So we're going to see, you know, we've talked so much about how the money in Illinois politics blew up in the last governor's campaign. But, man, oh, man, you've got $50 million in Bruce Rauner's campaign fund now from one donation from himself. You're having millions and millions poured in on all sides. This is going to be something like we've never experienced before. I just wonder how many seconds in the day can you fill with media and put in front of voters to have this all this be effective? At what point do we become numb to all this?
Yeah,
we're going to find out.
Yeah, we certainly will. You know, of course, we're at 22 months now without a state budget, and it seems like the blame game between Governor Rauner and Democrats is kind of stuck on repeat here. Last week, Governor Rauner was on WBEZ in Chicago describing what he thinks killed the so-called grand bargain, blaming House Democrats. Brian, you did a lot of reporting on this when the grand bargain kind of died here a couple months ago. What actually happened there?
Yeah, what happened? Look, the governor's point on WBEZ was that you had Democratic interest groups pressuring Democrats, like, you know, labor unions and people like that who didn't want to see the pension changes and some of the workers' comp changes that were being negotiated. That's true. On the Republican side, you had Governor Rauner and anti-tax and conservative groups pushing against some of the aspects of that. That is also true. What's different is that the Democrats in the Senate were ready to vote, and they resisted the pressure of their interest groups. And on the Republican side, the Republicans seemed to be resisting the pressure of the outside interest groups. And it was only when Governor Rauner himself started reaching out, communicating, conveying, you know, there was some talk initially that he had threatened Senate Republicans. None of my reporting actually bore that out. No one would at least admit to me that they had felt threatened by the governor, although, you know, with $50 million in his campaign account, he doesn't exactly have to wave a stick in front of you to have that be implicit in when he's asking you not to vote for something. But yes, the bottom line is here, the grand bargain came, you know, crashed and burned because Governor Rauner said he didn't think the deal was ready yet, and Senate Republicans did not want to get too far ahead of their party leader.
That's all we have time for today. But Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio State House reporter, and Matt Dietrich, editor of Reboot Illinois, thanks so much for joining us today on the 21st.
Thanks, Brian.
Happy to do it.
We're out of time for today, but you can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. We're produced by Christine Herman and Alan Montecelio. Abrar Alhiti is our intern. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help today from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks so much for listening.